Well, hi, folks. We are moles in the ground. In some ways, desecrated in many places, a ruined, toxified country on Earth, as to the environment and its politics. But this land of ours, this United States, it's also sacred ground, hallowed from centuries of struggle. The best things in this country, let me give you a list, the Bill of Rights, the room here for fight back and struggle by the previously super-subordinated, so many groups and colors and those that differ from some arbitrary norm. The remaining space for political dissent, to be sure under attack, but we're defending it. The small d democratic experiments. How about universal public education? It once was a wonderful system and can be again. One final great feature of this country, the music, dance, comics, fiction, so distinctly developed here, like jazz, the blues, country, folk, rap, hip-hop, of course, all coming from the grassroots. Then, yes, commercialized and exploited, but also widely disseminated and still carrying its resistant, critical, hopeful messages. And also some money-making messages, of course. The most notable achievements of this country, how have they arisen? Well, in democratic struggle, in popular creativity from below, for a people seeking rich, fulfilling lives. This radio station, KBOO Portland, Oregon, in its 48 years, it's contributed to that struggle and all of its programming and its music and public affairs, too. For KBOO honors the work of ordinary folks. KBOO critiques are increasingly top-down and polluting society. KBOO promotes authentically democratic and sustainable lifeways. This is the second Monday of our about two-week membership drive, the last Monday. If you listen to KBOO and want to keep us on the air, please call, become a member, renew, donate. Show your appreciation and support for the programs that so enrich your life, that bring you the most interesting and thoughtful people on this planet, that remind you that you are not alone, that there are so many who love and support the values that you want to live by. We want you to call and become a member, or go on the internet, of course, and go to the tip jar. This show, the Old Mole Variety Hour, we try to contribute, to do our bit. On today's Mole, it's Criminal Justice Day. We examine today's intensifying struggle led by Afro-American movements. I'm Bill Resnick, your host today. I talked to Teresa Rayford of Don't Shoot Oregon about the many challenges to a rotten and murderous system, challenges now occurring in Oregon. Also today, Mole's Jen Hacken and Mike Snedeker discuss the death penalty. There's a on the California ballot, Measure 66. It's a ballot measure to abolish the death penalty. There's many other issues of the death penalty, some of them little recognized, but terrible consequences, especially how it generates thousands of living deaths in prison for life and without parole. Last today, Tom Becker reads from an essay by Dave Lindorf entitled, Can Capitalism and Mankind Both Survive? U.S. journalists duck the big climate question. We're first going to hear from Teresa Rayford. Welcome to KBOO. Teresa Rayford?
Are you able to hear me?
Ah, yes. Teresa, welcome to KBOO.
Well, thank you, and I guess it's a welcome back.
That's right. I've heard you've been on a few times, and that's why we have you again today. Teresa Rayford is a leader in Don't Shoot Oregon, other social justice organizations, putting the pressure on for what the establishment media calls criminal justice, quote, reform. In fact, reform is a real misnomer. In fact, it has to be a complete transformation of the police, the sentencing systems, the treatment of prisoners, the responsibilities of judges and prosecuted attorneys, among many, many other things. Teresa, you're right now on the road to Salem, going to meet with prison officials at the state penitentiary. Tell us briefly, what are you going to be talking to them about?
Well, basically, we're looking at a couple of different issues that are happening out there around prisoner safety during the transfer process. Also, the accommodations inside when there's different issues as far as protests, riots, and, you know, different extreme situations and their ability to be able to speak out. We're just going out there, hopefully, to have a meeting to start opening up the conversation around these things and what can we do to help with building their access to their rights.
Right. You're also, I understand, starting a conversation about the cuts in funding and the way in which they're dealing with them, which is to cut all of the prison programs that, in fact, are really necessary for people to live there in with some sort of sense of hope and things to do.
Absolutely, because their right to freedom of expression and access to education, a lot of that is playing into some of the discrepancies that are happening out there in regards to their safety, their access to these programs. I was out there on Saturday, and I got to watch a play that was produced called The Bucket, and it was, you know, the person that's bringing it out there, this brother Phil, they've been doing this for about 9 years throughout institutions across the country, but they have limited access to funds, and then they have to deal with the bureaucracy within the inside. But what's happening is that by bringing this art programming in there, what it's doing is it's helping the prisoners not only have a different type of peace of mind where they're avoiding, you know, situations like solitary confinement or the destruction and, you know, of what happens when you go into the wards for the hospital care, but they're able to start using restorative justice techniques and different tools to accommodate the support of these programs, and it's changing the culture within. But if we're looking at defunding these programs or not having them have access to it, it's another step backwards. So one of the things that I'm doing now is just going out there really to try to advocate for this, because you know, I'm in the car now with Matt from the ACLU. Being incarcerated, when they first created penitentiaries, it was for penance, and we thought that it was going to be a situation for rehabilitation. But without programming that basically keeps you connected to the outside world or keeps you thinking critically or keeps you being creative, we're basically going to be facing people that are coming out of this system that have no that are numb to what's happening out here, you know, that have a different reality. And what we see is recidivism when people return back because they feel like they can't adjust to what's happening. So we're saying that having these programming and making sure that education is available, that is a human right, and it doesn't only benefit those on the inside, it also benefits us and their families when they come outside to regular society.
Right. You know, we talked about recidivism. It's also, of course, because not only do people become often hardened and lose sight of important values in prison, they also often face huge fines. They cannot get jobs. Their past follows them forever. Proclaiming your innocence or does you no good at all. You can't vote. All of those things. There are so many attacks. There are so many burdens that people who have been in jail face. That's also part of the story of recidivism, I understand. You know, there's so much wrong with prisons, the violence that's encouraged often. The guards do it and they encourage it. You know, the solitary confinement, health system, the food. I'd like to talk about today, though, just for a few minutes, your project with the Lewis and Clark Law School with regard to who goes to jail and how it happens and whether there are appeals and the power of prosecutors. Tell us about that issue.
Okay. Yeah, well, this past weekend, I connected with Corinne Fletcher, who is a Lewis and Clark law student, and also just working with all these other students. I think there might have been about 13 of them. But they're working with students in McLaren, with the youth in McLaren, to kind of identify ways to avoid the mandatory sentencing and the Measure 11 crimes. They're looking at different trends that not only occurred maybe in the school system, but also with the community partnerships that were relative to the policing issues that determined that incarceration was going to be the next step for some of these at-risk youth. And if you notice, there is a trend in communities of poverty. There's a direct line through the education system that gets those children into our incarcerated institutions. So working with those youth, you're able to stand right there with them before they're going into the Department of Corrections to kind of evaluate how exactly did you get here. You know, one of the questions that I asked during a group conversation with the teens this past weekend was, at what point, when was the first time that somebody told you were bad? And they were like, what? And everybody responded, like, basically school and all this. And I was like, whoa, really? A place where you go to learn and be educated and kind of consider what words mean and what actions mean and what you can do instead of instructing a child into doing different things, we identified them as being certain things. And then we connect that identity with who they are. So black children in Portland, if they live in North and Northeast Portland, no one's looking at their economic status. They're looking at the color of their skin, and they're saying that they're at risk or disadvantaged. And right. I had a lot of children that were saying to me, like, what does that mean? You know, they had no idea that that was systemic language that was basically identifying where their positioning in society was and, you know, to the detriment.
Teresa, in the first part of the interview, Teresa Rayford and I discussed some current work in the prison system with regard to trials and sentencing, with regard to the prisons, but also the trials and sentencing, especially about children who are inducted into the system, often for a lifetime. Teresa, there's so much now going on, the attack on Stop and Frisk, on racial profiling, on the blue wall of silence, cops will never tell the truth about themselves. The plea bargaining system. There are now movements and struggles in every one of these areas and more. Teresa, what's your sense? Why are the police, the prisons, even the prosecutors all now beginning to listen to us when not long ago they ran things in the same authoritarian way? Now they're getting a little nervous. What's happening?
Well, Bill, I think that we've changed the strategy in our protests. I think that by asking for audits and demanding investigations of certain situations and institutions, that people are more likely to take you seriously because you're asking to get the information in writing. You're not pointing a finger. You're saying, well, let me see what you're doing. And I think that when you do that, that things that are already being said and complaints that have been made in the past, that they come to the surface because now they're highlighted. There's a magnifying glass on them. And so we're not saying anything new in our protest now with the Black Lives Matter movement. These are certain things that have been said over the last 50, 60 to 100 years. But when you ask for these audits and you demand accountability in the form of an investigation, or if you're indicting your local leaders or, you know, superintendents of school boards and things of that sort, things tend to get a little bit more clearer for those that are opposed to even believing that there's an issue. And so once that accountability point is factored in, you have to deal with it. You know, they have to listen to us at this point.
Uh-huh. Yes, the anger and an explosion about the killing of black men, women, and children, unarmed people, under extremely suspicious circumstances, some of them caught on video. But the explosion of anger at this killing, it seems to me, has had an enormous, enormous effect, including now the uniting of so many organizations, social justice groups, Black Lives Matter, Don't Shoot Oregon, many, many, many others who have been pushing for, quote, prison reform. They're now getting on board and moving towards a united struggle against the criminal, to really transform the criminal justice system. We'll have to talk about that soon, particularly the policy document that you contributed to that's by the Movement for Black Lives. It's really very important. It's not just about the criminal justice system. It is the whole system that leads to so many people in the bottom half and above that in this society to...
Well, Bill, you know these root causes are intersections. So
right.
if you're not looking at the different levels and the different...
Right. Teresa,
you're not getting the whole picture.
We're going to have to talk about that again. Thanks so much for talking. You were great. Have a good day in Salem, and keep up all of the good work you're doing.
All right, and let listeners know, I volunteered there, too. Don't be afraid to call. Make those phones ring. Keep cable on the air. Thank you, Bill.
Thank you, Teresa.
This is the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. Thanks so much to our new members, as well as those of you who are renewing your memberships this morning. I'm Jan Hawken, talking with Mike Snedeker by phone today. Mike, thanks for being with us.
You're welcome.
Well, in addition to your steady and smart work here on the Old Mole and as a KBOO volunteer, you have a job as an appellate lawyer working on death penalty appeals, primarily in California. California has the largest death row number of inmates on death row in the country with more than 660 prisoners, yet it executes very few people. Over 80% of executions are in the South. Well, on November 8th, California's people will vote on two competing initiatives about the death penalty, Proposition 62, which would repeal capital punishment and replace the death penalty with life without parole. Proposition 66 would retain the death penalty and streamline the appeal process in capital cases. Well, first, let's talk about this puzzling pattern in California, as well as the relationship between capital cases and life without parole, and then perhaps turn to whether Proposition 62 is really a step forward with respect to criminal justice reform. First, enlighten us about these numbers that there are. Over double the number of people on death row in California compared to Texas that executes a staggering number.
Well, California has become the new death belt for Southern California, with Riverside County as the buckle. In the last year, there were more people sentenced to death in Riverside County than in Texas, Louisiana, and Alabama combined. The death penalty has made a retreat in the Deep South, mainly for fiscal reasons and mainly because crime and punishment is no longer the number one issue for politicians anywhere in the country. But what we see is a demonstration of how arbitrary the death penalty is. In Riverside County, there's a new DA, and he obtained 7 death penalty convictions in the first half of 1950. The BBC even did a documentary on it. That was more than the entire Deep South during that time span. And if you look at where death penalty convictions come from, it's dependent on prosecutors. And Houston, Texas was the major source of death penalty convictions, Harris County, until one particular prosecutor lost an election and the number of prosecutions dropped to 0. And you can see the most ambitious prosecutors also have the most wrongful convictions. Just last month, Roger King died in Philadelphia. He had obtained 7 death penalty convictions, and all of them, nobody's been executed yet because they were all bad. By bad, I mean he suppressed evidence showing that an eyewitness had identified a tall and light-skinned perpetrator rather than the short, the dark person who was actually convicted. The Brady errors, or that is, failures to turn over to the defense exculpatory evidence, was a matter of work. That's how that was his style. It was a routine. There are people who are so ambitious that they cut corners, they fail to comply with the law, and they get more convictions that way. And when they leave, for whatever reason, the number of prosecutions drops, the number of convictions drops. So I think, you know, I could say that Los Angeles, San Bernardino, Kern County, and Riverside, they're very different culturally. Los Angeles has an excuse of having more than 10 million people, but those are the places where people have been convicted.
So one response to the power of prosecutors is to rein in that power. Another is to beef up the defense and resources that go to defense. And yet another is to use this to once again show the arbitrariness and systematic discrimination accompanying capital punishment. How would you respond to this in terms of meaningful reform?
Those are both good ideas. Riverside County is miserably underfunded. The public defender's office, private counsel there, very rarely know what they're doing. They do a bad job. L.A. County, they do a bit. They're smarter and more capable, but they are overwhelmed with the numbers of prosecutions. It was very difficult. If there were equal, or not even equal, but reasonable funding for the defense bar, that would help a lot.
So let's talk about this alternative, life without possibility of parole, or life without parole, LWOP, as it's called, and whether this is really a step forward. Many of the surveys that show quite dramatic drops in support for capital punishment in this country also suggests that people are more apt to support life sentences or life without parole. And indeed, that this is built in as an option, as the alternative to the death penalty in Proposition 62. What can you first explain what that means? And some of this is cost. If you read the millions of dollars on each case it's spent on a capital case, it's staggering in millions of dollars. So one argument is this is too expensive. And so there's the economic argument, which I think is always problematic to tally progress through that metric. But could you first explain this option other than the cheaper route? What's involved from your perspective as an appellate lawyer in cases that lead to life without the possibility of parole?
Well, life and death are very different things. They're qualitatively different. And I think that so long as you're alive, something can happen internally within you or externally in the larger society.
But almost no one ever is pardoned who is sentenced with life without parole, from what I understand.
Well, I'm saying that death penalty is definitely worse, but it does suck all the air out of the room. And we have a sorry state now where the idea of a sentence of life in prison without possibility of parole is regarded as the humane alternative. But I don't think we'll be able to confront what that really means until the death penalty is abolished.
And why is that? When you say it sucks all the air out of the room, can you say more what you mean by that?
Well, whether or not we can kill somebody, there's so many philosophical issues raised about the power of the state and the whole issue of super due process. If death penalty cases are phenomenally expensive, but where they're not expensive, they kill innocent people, because crime and punishment is government work, and there are mistakes made. The police make routine mistakes. On law and order, they're competent. They're kind of the soul of the nation. They are always morally correct, even if they overstep. They're smart. They're quick. That's not real life. Real life is riddled with errors, with overly ambitious, competitive DAs and cops, people who don't care, and other people who are just dense, other people who are supposedly scientists are stupid. And
so this Proposition 6...
They're good people. So that means that there's going to be mistakes made, and with the death penalty, you can't fix them. The person is dead. So if you have the only way to do a death penalty system at all is with some kind of super due process where you spend more time and more money. But if you don't, so the economic argument is a recognition of the fact that death penalty is something that is irrevocable.
And this Proposition 66 plays on that concern about the costliness of death penalty appeals and proposes to streamline the appeal process in capital cases. What about that streamlining?
It's a whole farce about these measures in California, because the way it's set up is there can be a majority of people vote against the death penalty, because you can vote on both these propositions. Many people who don't like the death penalty will also vote for the one that says it's going to speed things up, because who wouldn't want a faster system? So you could have a scenario where no on death gets 52% of the vote, but the speed-up measure, which will, like all speed-up measures, slow everything down, could get 56% of the ballot, and it would then prevail. And it is a very wacky system. It demolishes death row. It moves people to counties. It has a kind of a slavery system where no lawyers will be able to get court of appeal appointments unless they take death penalty cases. So you will have people suddenly with lawyers, but with lawyers who have never done a death penalty case and have no clue what's going on. So whatever happens in the outcome will be appealed. It's just going to be a sloggy mess.
So just returning in our last few minutes to this sentence of life without possibility of parole, you're saying that is the inhumanity of that must be addressed, but it gets so overtaken with the issues with the death penalty that it's very difficult to really address the suffering associated with that. Can you say a bit about that sentence and what that's like for people? Just we have a few more seconds.
Well, you're living in a room the size of a ping pong table for your whole life. It's inhumane. It's a horrible sentence. It could never be in effect. I think when people say the psychology of it, there are people who manage to sort of surmount that with their own psychology, but most people are crushed by it and immiserated. And I think the real psychology of it, though, has got to be and can only be addressed in depth after we get rid of the death penalty.
Okay. Well, thanks so much, Mike, for your good work on around prisoners' rights and working around death penalty appeals, and also your fabulous work here on the Old Mole, where we routinely talk about left in the law and stories you don't hear covered on the everyday mainstream corporate news.
Next on the Old Mole on KBOO, a change of pace. Tom Becker reads from Dave Lindorf's webpage, This Can't Be Happening. The essay is entitled, Can Capitalism and Mankind Both Survive? U.S. journalists duck the big climate question. Tom?
Good morning. Today, as Bill says, I'm reading from an article on This Can't Be Happening webpage. Scientists have for decades recognized climate change as an existential crisis facing mankind. But the U.S. media, hamstrung by a self-inflicted obsession with presenting both sides of every story, even when there is only one, have only begun recognizing its gravity. And a huge barrier still prevents climate change from being honestly reported. That barrier is mainstream journalistic inability to address the central role global capitalism plays in propelling climate change, and to expose the determined, collaborative, and usually carefully hidden role it plays in stymieing the profound government actions needed to prevent, or at least fend off, catastrophe. Consider Newsweek's annual list of America's greenest companies. Two top industrial companies on the green list are General Motors and Coca-Cola. The former aggressively builds and markets grossly overweight gas-sucking SUVs in China and pushes high-markup gas-swilling large vehicles in the U.S., and the latter, a massive global water waster, exists to make a product, flavored sugar water, that serves no useful purpose whatsoever. Both companies score high on the Newsweek list for reducing their carbon footprint. Great as far as it goes, but corporate journalism fails by not pointing out that sustainability efforts are irrelevant if the larger goal is producing more and bigger cars or selling even more bottles of carbonated sugar water. Earth's climate is approaching a dangerous tipping point of no return. The UN Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change has yet to factor into its climate models the near certainty of catastrophic methane releases from the Arctic seabed and the permafrost underlying the Siberian and North American tundra, releases that threaten to push global temperatures to levels never experienced in mankind's history. Some scientists warn this could happen any time. Indeed, huge craters recently discovered in the remote tundra of Siberia caused by methane eruptions and Arctic lakes and sea surfaces regions now boiling with the released methane suggest it's already happening. Meanwhile, Greenland's ice sheet's melt is accelerating, rendering obsolete ice loss predictions almost as they are being made. Yet as bad as that sounds, things may well be worse, because it's not just journalists who are ducking the issues. Scientists are facing similar pressures to soft-pedal their research findings on climate change. Universities increasingly are requiring professors, particularly in the sciences, to obtain research grants as part of their income, nearly all of which are funded by corporations. And those corporations or corporate-backed foundations, even if they don't say they expect a certain research outcome, impose constraints right in the application process on what they want looked into. As Kevin Anderson, a professor of energy and climate change at Manchester University in the UK, explains, there's a very clear understanding amongst virtually all of the academics I engage with, whether directly on projects, or simply through discussions following seminars, that growth is sacrosanct. Economics trumps physics. Only by reducing the amount of stuff produced and by dampening, not encouraging society's acquisitiveness and succession, only by abandoning an economic model where growth is good and corrupt and companies must grow or die, can there be any hope of avoiding the disaster of runaway climate change. It's hard to be optimistic that journalists themselves can do this. If academic researchers, most of whom have tenure and thus don't have to fear being fired, are caving in to funding pressures to soft-pedal their findings or avoid addressing certain issues like the role of consumer-driven capitalism and free market economics in propelling increased greenhouse gas emissions, how much more vulnerable are journalists who have no such job security? Fighting to tell the truth when the bosses don't want the truth told calls for a courage that is, sadly, in short supply these days in a profession where jobs are scarce and getting scarcer every year. U.S. GDP is comprised 72% of consumer spending. If that spending drops, the economy swoons. If companies sell less, their stock plummets, CEOs are dumped, and workers are sacked. Yet if rampaging climate change is to be avoided, production of non-essential goods clearly must be slashed. Houses and cars must become fewer, smaller, and more efficient. Clothing more utilitarian. Mass transit more available. Agriculture closer to where produce is consumed. Eventually, population growth must be halted and even reversed. And since the vast majority of the world's population that lives in poverty need to raise their standard of living, it means that the wealthy countries and the rich in those countries need to drastically reduce their consumption of goods and their carbon footprints. All that means that the whole global socioeconomic system has to be radically changed, with far more of a focus on sharing, on equity, and on community. American mainstream journalism isn't saying these things, and it certainly isn't asking the big question, can capitalism and mankind coexist? The reason journalists aren't asking is that they know the uncomfortable answer. No, they cannot. Yet if mankind is to reach the next century, journalists need to ask that question. We need to ask a follow-up question, too. If modern global capitalism is driving catastrophic climate change and is also preventing action to stop it, what needs to be done? That was a reading by Dave Windorf on the This Can't Be Happening webpage entitled, Can Capitalism and Mankind Both Survive? U.S. Journalists Duck the Big Climate Question.
Yes, thank you. Thank you, Tom Becker. Capitalism is at war with natural ecosystems, and the climate scientists say that the current course leads to the abyss, to cataclysm, to the extinction of most life forms, including us Homo sapiens. But how to transform world economic systems and life ways of the well-to-do and the filthy rich? If you want to learn about this, about climate change, about what can be done, and what can you do, KABU is your station. Of course, the downside is KABU doesn't have much weather or sports or bachelorettes or even Kardashians. That's all for the old mole for today. We want to give thanks to Teresa Rayford, Mike Steniker, Jan Hocken, Tom Becker, engineer Patricia Kullberg, and thanks to Per and Justin and all those who support KABU and our show. Join us again next week for more news, views, reviews, and interviews from the Mole's Underground Perspective. I'm Bill Resnick, your host today, signing off for the Old Mole. See you next Monday at 9. One final thing, if you haven't done it yet, please call, become a member. It's never too late to reach out and help some wonderful radio station. Thanks a lot. Bye.